I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of one man who has the kind of memories of arriving in America that are fast becoming a piece of American history.
Between 1880 and 1924, nearly 25 million immigrants left their homelands for America. Half came through Ellis Island.
And as the clatter of the ship's gangways began to fall silent at Ellis Island, a young boy, 6-year-old John Henry Wilberding from rural Germany, stepped down from his ship with a look of wonder.
Where is this somewhere?
America was something that was foreign to me.
John didn't make it through the health inspection. He had the measles. He was quarantined inside the Ellis Island Hospital. And yet still, his first memories of America gave him a pride in his new home that he still holds today. I'll talk with him after the news. As the focus of presidential politics moves on to Texas now, the fight over illegal immigration is bound to come back into focus. Both Republican candidates support the current plan to build walls and fences that will keep Mexican and other Latinos from crossing the southern border. 100 years ago, the political attitude about immigration was quite different.
Millions of every nation and calling, drawn together by their vision of America, a vision of land, opportunity and freedom.
80 years ago, John Wilberding came to America, as so many others did at that time, through Ellis Island.
I believe in immigration. I believe that people should be able to come to America, but in an orderly way. We have enough walls.
John is one of the very few who made the journey through Ellis Island who can talk today about what it was like then and why it still matters. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
John Henry Wilberding was 6 years old when his family left Germany for America. Now, his parents went first. They sailed ahead to America to get things ready. So John and his brothers ended up crossing on the elegant new ocean liner, the Columbus. For those in first class, it boasted vaulted ceilings, original murals, and walls of mirrors. For a 6-year-old boy, it was enchanting.
Gosh, we saw everything on every deck. And the most wonderful thing that I recall was eating in a beautiful dining room where there was white linens and silver.
This was quite a contrast for you, John. I mean, you'd come from really quite a small home in Germany, had you not?
Oh, yes, yes. In those days, the house and the barn were connected, all under one roof. Living was in the back, and the front part was where the animals lived. It had a thatched roof, and it wasn't too small. It wasn't a cottage.
Still, the shift from that to life on board the steamship Columbus, though.
It's hard to explain. You have to visualize it. A little boy with his 3 brothers going on a ship. Everything strange. I was leaving the warmth of the home that I knew with my grandmother. I was just wondering what's going to happen next.
What happened next was not what the family had planned. 2 of the Wilberding boys, John and his younger brother, were nabbed by the health inspectors and quarantined at the Ellis Island Hospital. It was measles. And John knew precisely when he caught them. It was saying goodbye to a friend, a little girl in Germany.
And I wanted to say goodbye to her. And so I ran away from my uncle's place and went to visit her and she said she was sick. Well, I wasn't concerned about that, and turned out she had the measles, and so I carried the measles germ with me. And
did anybody say anything on board the Columbus? Were there any spots appearing on your skin or on your brother?
Apparently not, because nobody mentioned it. It wasn't detected until we were in port in New York. Doctors determined that I and my brother, who was 8, had the measles. And that stopped our journey to America.
Yeah, what happened then? Because there were 4 of you, 2 brothers with the measles and 2 without.
My stepfather was there waiting, and he was going to take 4 boys to Michigan. Well, when he was notified of the fact that two of them had the measles, he had to make arrangements for us to stay in the hospital. So my brother and I were transferred to Ellis Island, to the hospital, and my stepfather and my two brothers went on to Michigan. And he promised that he'd come back after us.
You must have been a little bit terrified. Here you were in a brand new country, you at age six, your brother was 8 years old, and there goes your stepfather, leaving you alone in the hospital.
Well, I'm sure that I was, but somehow those feelings disappeared. Because when we got on Ellis Island, it seemed that suddenly we came into a place where people cared. My brother and I, we had a room together, and the orderlies and the nurses, the men and the women, treated us like we were guests rather than patients. And although many of them couldn't talk the language, it just worked out. It was so beautiful, America.
This is pretty important, what you're telling me, because your first day, your first week in America, and you're forming ideas about the country based on the way that you're being treated by the grown-ups in the hospital.
Yes. It was so ingrained in me that the people, they cared, they had concern, especially here, two little boys, you know, away from their parents. They took extra time with us. There's an instance, the first time I had spaghetti. Didn't know what it was. Here's a plate of spaghetti and had red stuff on it. We didn't know what ketchup was either. And so we had it on a tray, and my brother said, "Let's hold the tray up over our head and let the plate slide and see how close to the edge it can get." Well, mine slipped off onto my bed, and little did I realize that the orderly was watching all of this. And all of a sudden, when it hit the bed, I looked, and there he was standing.
You weren't punished?
No, no, no. He had a smile on his face. Well, we were trying to clean it up, and he knew we weren't going to get anywhere there. So he helped us clean it up, and he changed the bed. And that was our sort of our greeting to America.
Now I have this image of you, John, lying on your hospital bed with your hands behind your head, saying to your brother Ben, "This is okay, I like it."
You're right.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. John Wilberding would not have known this at the time. He was only six. But because he was sick when he arrived, it was entirely possible he might have been sent back to Germany.
Yes, there were many of them that happened to them. But apparently, the contagious disease hospital that we were in was something that you could get over. And it was not something there was a permanent disfigurement or something like that. And so we were placed there. And, of course, my stepfather had to pay for the hospital room. And in a few days, 10 days, 2 weeks, we were on our way.
Did you and Ben have a room to yourselves?
Yes. We found out years later that my mother insisted that we not be in a ward, and that she wanted her two boys in a room if it were possible. And he made it possible.
What do you remember of that room?
The one thing that I remember, it was out of our window. In the distance, there was something tall. We didn't really know what it was. And we kept watching it and looking at it. And somehow it was described to us. And I remember the word Statue of Liberty. But it really didn't mean anything to us at the moment. But we could see that out of our room.
From the window that you looked out of, John.
Yes.
Which direction was she facing? Were you looking at her back or at her side? What do you recall?
Well, I don't really recall. I think it was more on the side.
You had no idea what she stood for as a symbol at that
time?
No.
We learned that it was the Statue of Liberty. But what it symbolized really two young boys weren't concerned about that.
Were you allowed the run of the hospital? Were you running around as you were on the ship?
Well, I did pretty well. Got in the cook's ways, got in the laundry room, and, you really shouldn't be running around. And they were very gentle in saying, you shouldn't do that. We squeeze her arm a little and talk to us.
They wanted you to stay in your room, I gather.
Well, yes. That's why we were there. You know, you could get hurt in the laundry room. You could get hurt in the kitchen. And it really wasn't the place for the patients.
John, how many days were you and Ben in that hospital room, just the two of you?
As I remember, we were 2 weeks.
It's fascinating to me that over even that long period of time, you didn't have any periods of homesickness or sadness, you know, feeling cut off from everything that was familiar, because really, you were in a brand new world, in a brand new place, with a brand new language, and you seemed to be okay with that.
Well, the thing was that we had each other, my brother and I. My mother wasn't there, but we also knew that my mother loved us and that this was being done, that we were going to a new place, and that we had to go through this to get to the new place. It didn't leave any scars on us. It left nothing but excitement and hope.
If you were on your own for a couple of weeks in Germany after your mother and stepfather left, mm-hmm. and then 10 days on the ship and a couple of weeks in the hospital on Ellis Island, it was well mm-hmm. more than a month that you were separated from your
yes.
mother, right? How well
yes.
do you remember the reunion in Michigan?
Oh, I remember that. Wonderful. There's a little town of Forest Hill, and that's where the train stopped. And my two brothers and my stepfather had a Model T. Gee, I thought that was a wonderful thing. About two and a half miles from where we lived. And here is this beautiful big house. So we came in, of course, the love and exchange with my mother, seeing her, oh, yay, yay. And I don't know whether I slept that night or not, but I remember the next morning, as we woke up and started down the stairs, there was a sun was shining through the window and hitting the stairway. Oh, I remember that. And then the door opened, and there was my mother. This was America. And it came in with the sunshine and the love of a mother.
John Wilberding arrived at Ellis Island in 1928. In later years, he fought for America in the Second World War, and so he also saw the Statue of Liberty as a returning serviceman. And I'll talk with him about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. John Henry Wilberding is one of the few people in America who has clear memories of arriving as an immigrant at Ellis Island. Now, I first saw John in a new documentary film about the plan to restore the hospital there.
Every immigrant who came to Ellis Island had to climb the large staircase that led to the Great Hall. At the top of the staircase stood uniformed public health service doctors who watched intently for signs of heart trouble, breathing difficulty, any kind of disability. It was the first test of the immigrant's fitness to become the laborers America was seeking.
I'll tell you a bit more about the film in just a few minutes. John Wilberding was six when he was quarantined along with his younger brother at the Ellis Island Hospital. They both had the measles. They spent 2 weeks there before being reunited with their mother in Michigan. Now, 15 years later, when America entered the Second World War, John enlisted in part to pay America back for being so good to his family. And the war took him back to close to where he was born, in Germany, in the winter of 1944.
We were ready to cross the Rhine. They were building the bridge, and the bridge was being built at Bad Godesberg, where my aunt lived. But I didn't have the opportunity to visit her. The feelings were mixed. You know, I was an American, and I was doing my duty for American, even though my father died from mustard gas. He was in the German army.
That's in the First World War, yeah.
Yes.
Did you feel, in a way, John, like you had to make something right with him or explain to him why you were there in Germany wearing a different country's uniform?
I don't know whether that was the feeling or not. It might well have been, but I used to sort of talk to him. Dad, I'm in another army. And it was a very private conversation. I knew that he would understand. He wasn't a warmonger, but he had to do his job, and he would understand I had to do my job.
I suppose that when you were finished fighting in Europe, you probably came back on a ship and perhaps even into New York Harbor, the same way you'd arrived.
Yes, I saw the Statue of Liberty.
Knowing full well at that stage what she stood for.
Oh, yeah. America.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. John Wilberding got married right after the war, and John kept telling his wife Ella about Ellis Island. He finally decided to take her there to see it. They went in 1998, 70 years after that day when John first set foot in America himself. And when they got there, they saw that the hospital complex had lain abandoned for decades. It had been pretty well ransacked, and vines were growing through the hallway windows.
We wanted to find the room that my brother and I was in. And I called Ellis Island, the National Park Service, and they told me that we couldn't get in the hospital area because it was run down. So I asked to talk to the superintendent. The lady was very nice, and I said, well, you know, two little boys spent the first 10 days in the hospital there. We'd like to find our room. There was a silence for a moment, and she said, when are you coming? And when we got to Ellis Island, we went into the big hall, and we were standing in the back, Ella and I, and way on the far end was, what do you call them, the park ranger. And he came straight toward us. He said, are you Mr. Wilberding? And I said, yes. He said, I would like to help you find your room. Gosh, we kept going and going, and I kept checking. It was just like a big dump. The tables were turned over. There was rust. There was just chaos. And the laundry rooms, everything seemed to be torn apart, and the plaster was falling. Filing cabinets were smashed up in different places.
It must have been a little bit upsetting for you to go back to see it in such a condition like that.
Well, it was, because it was such an important place. Ellis Island was a stepping stone to happiness and freedom. The ability to raise a family, to enjoy the fruits of your labor. It boggles the mind. I don't have the words, but I have the feelings. But to express them is beyond me. So finally we came to one of the hallways, and he said, this is the last one. And it was an end room, and I turned left and looked out the window, and there I could see the Statue of Liberty. Once again, to see that symbol.
Was it emotional for you to be back in that room looking through that window at the Statue of Liberty?
Very emotional. One of the German ideas was that you don't show, you know, your feelings. You got to be brave. Well, the tears flowed.
John, I had one more question for you, and that's a question of what's going on in the country right now. As you know full well, there's quite a debate about immigration in America right now. Should, you know, people from south of the border be allowed to cross in and live here and work here without the necessary papers? And people are pretty divided about that. Having come in the manner that you did through Ellis Island, how do you look at that debate?
Well, I believe in immigration, but I also believe in the fact that there are rules and regulations that we had to follow. And it's not because I had to do it, but I think there has to be an order in all things. I think we can handle immigration if we put away a lot of our idiosyncrasies about this group, this group, this group, and look at the values of human beings, what we can do for them. There's a limit, of course, but I think we so often try to find such an easy solution. And I don't think immigration is an easy solution. It's a difficult one. But as an immigrant, I believe in immigration. I believe that people should be able to come to America, but in an orderly way.
So when you see on the news that big walls are going up on the southern border of Texas and Arizona, how does that make you feel?
Well, we have enough walls that are mental walls, and we create within our lives many walls. I shudder at that. There must be a better way. America is still the place where people care for each other.
I read somewhere, John, that over 100 million Americans can trace their place here in this country back to someone like you who came through Ellis Island.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of all your grandchildren and great-grandchildren, mm-hmm, as you talk about that. And I also know that people have talked about Ellis Island as the closest thing this country has to a national shrine. I'm curious to know what it means to you, what Ellis Island represents to you, how you describe it to your own family.
It's profound, but it's profound in your own heart. It's my country. It's my home.
John Henry Wilberding joined me from a studio in Mount Pleasant, Michigan. The documentary filmmaker who put us in touch with John is Laurie Conway. She's just recently finished her film and its companion book, both called Forgotten Ellis Island. You can find links to both the film and the book at our website at thestory.org. Forgotten Ellis Island will air on PBS this summer. In fact, it's Laurie's work and the advocacy of many others that have helped prompt the National Park Service to rescue the hospital at Ellis Island and to add that building to the tours that are now available there. Yesterday on The Story, I talked with John Staples about his own memories of the attack on Iwo Jima. John was a Marine second lieutenant who went ashore on the first day of the assault, February 19, 1945. That was also John's 23rd birthday. He talked with me about moving from their first night's exposed position on the beach to a slightly more sheltered place.
All those Marines in the next wave after us that took our foxholes, they were all killed that night. And I don't know why. I'm sure all those guys, they were praying too. Our lives were saved because we just moved up a little bit and told our men to move up. And they said, "Hey, we just dug in." We said, "Let's go. Let's move up." So we moved up a little bit. So one of them, the next morning when he looked down and I said, "How you doing, Chuck?" He said, "I'm doing all right till I saw all those dead guys down there in those foxholes that we dug." And I said, "Well, come on, Chuck. Don't be staring at them." I said, let's get moving.
After John Staples told his story, a number of you wrote in with your own recollections of that time. Thanks for that. We will go through those notes in some detail. One such letter came to me from Chelius in Holly Springs, Mississippi. He wrote of being named in tribute to his mother's older brother, 2nd Lieutenant Chelius C. Howard, a fighter pilot who was killed in action over Germany. "I cannot recall a time in my childhood that I was not more than a little curious about this uncle," wrote Chelius. "In 1978, I began to seek men, pilots, who knew him over there, and I began the long process of finding the precise spot where he was killed, finalizing this odd task some 20 years later and resolving a missing chapter in my family's history. Chelius wrote of meeting and interviewing eyewitnesses to this crash, and one RAF veteran who'd stumbled across his uncle's grave in the woods, next to the wreckage of his P-51 Mustang. These stories that help us all look at who we are and where we come from, these are the ones that I find relate to most of us. If you have the time to send me just a few lines about a family story of yours that matters, I always appreciate that. You can find me at thestory.org. Yesterday on The Story, I talked with a man whose life was altered by a chance encounter with Richard Pryor. I got another letter from a fellow named Peter Polhammer who told me of his encounters with the great American baritone William Warfield. Here's Warfield singing "You Is My Woman" from Porgy and Bess.
Bess, you is my woman now. You is, and you must sing and laugh and dance for two instead of one.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Peter Polhammer grew up listening to William Warfield albums at home, and he was passionate about Warfield's rendition of Old Man River. So when the chance came to see Warfield in person, Peter was ecstatic. He jumped in the car with his family for the hour-and-a-half ride to Chicago, just hoping to hear Warfield sing Old Man River.
I was disappointed when I looked at the program and saw it was nothing but French, German, and English art songs.
I don't know any of these.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I had a smattering appreciation of a few of them, but it was a wonderful program, and he handled all of those musical styles with the same adeptness that he sang everything.
Yeah, you'd seen him in film, but what was his stage presence like?
You know, when he started singing, it was just, there was no effort. And I think that was what I remember even to this day. It was just absolutely effortless. He just stepped up and he stood in the crook of that piano, and everything just came so easily.
And so did you ever get any of the familiar songs?
When the concert finished, he went off stage and the audience wouldn't let him go. You know, they called him back out, and so he came back out and he did an encore. And my mother and I looked at each other and I thought, okay, here we go. This is going to be it. Old Man River, that was what I was really anticipating. And no, it was another English folk song. And I was, oh, well, okay. You know, it was nice to hear. Well, he went off stage a second time. Well, the audience, I mean, it was just, they were not going to let him go. So they brought him back out for a second encore. And okay, well, here we go. No, now it's some, I don't know, it's another American folk song or something. Still was not, it's like, please, you know.
It was going to make you work for it, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they brought him back out for a third encore. He came out and I heard those opening chords.
There's an old man called a Mississippi.
And it was Old Man River, and I tell you, I just about melted in my seat. You could have poured me from the balcony down into the main floor.
What does he care if the world's got troubles? What does he care if the land ain't free?
It was absolutely wonderful.
He did a good job of it, did he?
Oh, I would say so. Yeah.
He didn't disappoint you.
No, he didn't.
But that wasn't the end of your afternoon at the Auditorium Theater.
No, it wasn't. Everything finishes now and everybody's getting up to go out. And my mother asked me, she says, well, would you be interested in trying to go backstage and see if we can meet him? And I looked at her and I said, oh, come on, Mom. This is William Warfield. What do you mean go backstage? So she asked one of the ushers, and the usher said, well, yeah, if you want to try, you know, you can come this way. And so my mother and I followed the usher, and we went backstage, and sure enough, there was William Warfield sitting on a stool in the hallway just greeting people as they came past. So it got to be our turn to step up and say hello. I reached out and he shook my hand and I mumbled something I'm sure that was fairly unintelligible under my breath. I mean, what do you say to a guy who you've been listening to sing this song on recording since you were knee-high to a grasshopper?
And you're a suave 17 years old at this
time.
Oh,
yeah. No kidding. And I start to walk off because there's still some more people in line behind that obviously want to have their chance to say hello. And I start to walk off and he won't let go of my hand. He won't let go of my hand and he pulls me back here and he says, young man, where do you think you're going? I'm not finished talking to you yet. It's kind of a voice that you didn't say no to. And I was just dumbfounded.
Well, what did you guys talk about?
Well, he wanted to know who I was, where I went to school, how old I was. I guess he must have gleaned that I had some interest in music or I wouldn't be standing in the line waiting to shake his hand. And so when I went to music contest, the piece that I took was Old Man River. And, I mean, it's hard to talk about sometimes. It's hard to think about. That piece was part of my musical vocabulary since I was at least 6 or 7 years old. So when it came time for me to select the piece that I was going to do, there was no question.
Peter Polhammer would later join the great baritone William Warfield in a master class, and then he'd face that question again, what to sing, this time in front of Warfield. Old Man River? We'll find out in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Peter Polhammer wrote in to tell me about his encounters with William Warfield, one of the great American stage singers of his time. Warfield died 6 years ago, but he was known worldwide for his roles in the musicals Porgy and Bess and Showboat. Now, Peter has pursued his own career on stage, and he says Warfield was a huge inspiration for that. At one point, Peter's voice coach, Mrs. Jordan, urged him to join a master class with Warfield. Peter was left wondering what he'd perform. Old Man River?
I wasn't sure if I wanted to or not because, you know, it's one thing to reach your hero backstage at a concert and have a chat for a few minutes over something. It's another thing to have to stretch your stuff in front of them. You know, what if you didn't measure up?
Better not to know.
Yeah, right. It's like going to the doctor and hearing negative information from your doctor. It's like, you know, I felt really good until you told me that I had
But
whatever,
you went, how many people were there?
There were probably something like 15 to 20 students there, all about my age. I decided, I went, and so Mrs. Jordan and I drove in together. It happens that she was African-American as well, and so it was an interesting thing because get to this church on the south side of Chicago and made our way into the room, and I'm the only white guy in there. Don't think that that
went unnoticed by you or them, I guess.
Yeah, right, by me, yeah.
Now, did everybody have to sing? Was everybody going to sing for you?
Okay. Yeah, yeah. That was the whole idea. You brought a piece prepared to sing, and he would take you, and then you would get some coaching. Everybody got the coaching in front of everybody else, too. So it wasn't like a private one-on-one thing. This was a classroom situation. So first of all, I had to decide early on what piece I was going to do. I debated with my voice teacher whether or not to do Old Man River, and we decided that probably wouldn't be the wisest choice to do. So instead, I took a piece by Franz Schubert. It was called Die Erlkönig. The opening piano bars to that piece are quite recognizable. It's a piece that goes... It's a song about a father who is riding home on a dark and stormy night with his son in his arms who happens to be very ill, and the son is greeted by the Earl King, the Elf King. And in German fairy tale mythology, the Elf King was a spirit who came for sick and dying children and took them. So it's a song full of torment and turmoil and so forth. Well, this is the one that I chose to do for this masterclass.
Were you one of the first to sing?
As I recall, I was. I don't know that I was absolutely the first, but I was certainly in the, you know, the first three or four.
What does he say?
The main bit of coaching that I took from him was about delineating the four different voices so that it's clear to the listener, even in a foreign language, that this is one character, this is another, and that there's this separation there. But more than that, it was about getting at the heart and soul of the music and not so much about really good technical production. As a matter of fact, I don't think that anything he said to me or any other student that day really had anything to do about technically producing a better tone or a better sound, or it was more about getting at the heart and soul of the particular piece of music. And I think, if anything, that's what I took out of that conversation, and what has stuck with me over the years is in finding a piece of music or a character in a play, what is the essence of the music? How is it that you give a different voice to the same piece of music than somebody else? What unique quality in you speaks that piece of music differently than the way somebody else does it?
Huh.
You've got to find that, because otherwise there's no sense to do the music.
Given that that was the feedback that you got from it, it was probably a good thing that you didn't do Old Man River. Because to do your version of Old Man River in front of Warfield.
Yeah.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Peter Polhammer told me that he was the only white kid at that master class. I asked him if he settled in or if he felt like an outsider.
I think it only took about 5 minutes after he walked in the room for everybody to find themselves at home in a completely relaxed atmosphere. That, to me, was part of the gift of Warfield, because within the first 5 minutes, we all understood that this was about music, and it was about making music, and the universal pull that everybody in the room had toward that goal. So after that, it didn't matter. None of those other things were, they were all superficial at best.
Mm-hmm.
But he came in and he set that tone.
Because it's interesting. He would have started performing at a time when it would have been very difficult for him to, you know, walk into a room full of white people and feel at ease. I just wonder if part of his grace in that church on that day was, you know, the experience that he'd been through.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, it was on the ride home from that experience. It was myself and Mrs. Jordan, who was an African-American woman. And I don't know whatever possessed me to say what I'm about to say, but she must have asked me how I felt about the whole thing. And I said there in the car to her, I said, well, you know, Mrs. Jordan, it felt strange at first being the only white person in the room. Now, I'm saying this to my African-American vocal coach at the university, and I don't know why, whatever possessed me to say it in that moment, but, you know, she asked me an honest question, and I gave her an honest answer, and without passing judgment on me for saying that, she said, That must be something on the order of what it might have been like for Mr. Warfield in his early career. And, you know, all at once, I felt kind of foolish for saying it, but relieved at the same time to feel that sense of commonality in that moment.
I'm talking with Peter Polhammer about his affection for the baritone William Warfield. Peter told me that Warfield had encouraged him to apply for a fellowship at the University of Illinois. And so he did that, and later moved to Central Illinois. Soon after, Peter ran into William Warfield in the music department.
And he said, oh, by the way, I'm having a party at my house on New Year's Eve, and I'd like it if you and your wife could come. You could have knocked me over with a feather, you know.
You told him you had other plans.
Yeah. Well, that was the night I set aside to wash my hair. So.
How many people were there?
I want to say that there was probably no more, at least when we were there, there was no more than, 30 people. Hmm. As I recall, it was kind of an open house affair that he had. I guess it was something that he did every year. But, you know, I honestly felt really honored to receive this personal invitation to something I wouldn't have known about otherwise. So my wife and I went, and we spent New Year's Eve 1982 at William Warfield's house in Champaign. And it was, boy, I tell you, he made the best sweet potato pie I have ever eaten in my life. And he made it from scratch. He had this buffet lined up there, and he says, and you've got to try some of this sweet potato pie. I just made this afternoon, and sure enough.
Did you ever talk to William Warfield about the way that his music inspired you from such a young age, how the concert that you saw as a teenager, how the class that you took in college affected you? Did you ever have a chance to tell him that?
Not in so many words. At the party is the one time that I recall actually talking to him about Old Man River specifically. I really was curious about how it felt for a singer of his stature to be so closely associated and be asked for a particular song time and again. Did he ever get tired of that? And his response actually kind of surprised me, because I had my own suspicions that I thought, you know, well, who wouldn't get tired of doing the same thing over and over and over again and be asked for it? But no, his response was, it was a song that he was proud to have been such an integral part of introducing to such a wide audience. And no, he would never, ever get tired of singing that song or being asked to sing the song, because it was, I think that it just become such a part of him.
Peter Polhammer says he has a very clear recollection of the time when William Warfield died, late in the summer, 2002.
I brought the Chicago Tribune in, pulled open the paper, and right on the front page was a headline indicating that Mr. Warfield had passed away the evening before. I looked at that headline, and it hit me like a brick in the head. I read the first two sentences, and I just burst into tears. And I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop crying, and I didn't know for sure why. I saw that, and all at once it hit me that this giant of the American music scene was no more. And I called my wife, and I was crying over the phone to her. I said, William Warfield has died. He's passed away.
And she would have known how much he meant to you.
Absolutely, yeah.
He was over 80. I think he was 82 years old when he died. I mean, he got to be the old man that he sang about all his life.
Yeah, yeah, he did. And the words and what the whole thing, you know, And this is something, too, you know, in that movie, Warfield is one of that character, Joe, is one of the few black characters that exists in American theater or movie literature at that time that's not a step-and-fetch-it character. He's a real live, flesh and blood, fully realized person.
With dignity.
Yeah, with dignity. And I think that's the thing. You know, you hear and you witness him sing this song. There's all this trouble and turmoil in the world, and my lot in life is to heave these bales of cotton day in, day out, and break my back and not get paid while other people prosper. Old Man River, he don't plant cotton, he don't, you know, he just keeps rolling along. It's and whatever happens to us in life, the river just keeps going. It's constant. It's there. The very end of the song, the last words, I get weary and sick of trying. I'm tired of living and scared of dying.
I'm tired of living and scared of dying. But Old Man River,
that Old Man River, he just keeps rolling along. It's not a song of despair at all. I think it's a song of recognizing reality and being able to be at peace with it one way or another. You know, I'm tired of living, but I'm scared of dying. So what's my choice? I've got to be here, and I've got to keep going. And yeah, he did that with dignity and with a sense of reality and above all, he was one who had this burning desire to lead other young singers onto a path that he had taken himself, and a recognition of the value of an individual human spirit without being judgmental about it. And that, I think that's what impressed me so much about William Warfield in those times that I had the opportunity and the honor to meet him. It was that everything was just meet a person where they are on their own terms and find out who they are, same as you would learning a new piece of music.
Peter Polhammer wrote in to tell me his story, and you can do exactly the same thing. I am wide open to these stories of unusual encounters with extraordinary people. We've got some great stories just about moments of departure, moments of arrival, moments that have meaning to you are those things that make great stories, and they are worth sharing. You can get in touch with me and let me know what you've got on your mind at thestory.org. Tomorrow, the story comes from Kenya, where people are still recovering and hoping for an end to the surprising post-election violence that has pitted major tribes against one another, different regions of the country. I'll talk with two friends, two young musicians from a studio in Nairobi. One of them, Tony, is Kikuyu. The other, Moses, is Luo. And like many people, they are still struggling to understand what happened to their country and to them.
Honestly, right now, Dick, if right now I heard Tony was in trouble, I'd take a bullet for him. That's just how it is, you know.
I wouldn't.
Me, I would. But you get the idea. We're young guys, and it's hard to believe that another young guy can just pick up. They probably went to the same school, you know. And you almost get the feeling that someone must be either feeding these guys with some information or getting paid to do something, you know.
I don't know. Yeah, it's hard to understand how it happened. It's people say it's tribal. We all think it's tribal, political, but I think there must be something else to it.
Tony and Moses will be with me on the program tomorrow talking about how they're making sense of what's happening in their country, in Kenya. Once again, if you have any thoughts on the program or suggestions of stories, you can get to me through our website at thestory.org or call and leave me a message on our telephone line, 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.